Hello, my name is Katie Doyle. I am the assistant curator here at the New Mexico Museum of Art in Santa Fe, New Mexico. It is 12:40 p.m. on Friday, May 19th, 2023. We are doing an oral history interview with Juliette Myers for the upcoming Rick Dillingham exhibition To Make, Unmake, and Make Again, which will be on view in the new wing. From October 6th through June 21st, 2024. So I guess without further ado, I will hand it over to Juliet. And that'll be biscuits.
Hello, I'm Juliette Myers, and I've had a little business here in Santa Fe called Art Artist Care that I started back in 1985, and with the help of one of my great mentors, Judy Chicago. I still have that business, though I've often worked as an art educator in museum settings, and I founded an art school. Hands-on art making for children and teens here in Santa Fe. So over all these many years, I've worn quite a few hats, but one of my favorite hats was the hat I wore with Dillingham. Judy Chicago introduced me to Rick Dillingham in around the holidays of 1984. I had recently arrived in Santa Fe. Judy had a holiday party, and I met several artists, and I had already met a few friends, and it was just feeling very much at home with the crowd. Judy is part of my history in that I did work on the Dinner Party Project in Santa Monica back in the mid-70s, and worked with Judy subsequently after the Dinner Party work opened, and worked on the books for the Dinner Party, the original Doubleday editions. Meeting Rick, of course, was a great joy because his energy, his demeanor, his handsome, long, tall gorgeousness was irresistible. And Judy said to Rick and some other artists at that holiday party, "Oh, Juliet should work for you." Well, Rick didn't miss a beat because every time she'd introduce me to someone, and some people said, "Well, why or what for?" Rick said, "Well, of course, when can you come to work?" So I went to work for Rick Dillingham in 1985. And as I said, I was working with Judy Chicago also at that time. So I think it was a very advantageous meeting. I became really close with Rick. One of my favorite things about Dillingham was that when I went to work for him, rather than giving me assignments of answering letters, and at that time, may I just say, the only thing on the desk was a very innovative thing called the Mac Classic. It was one of the earliest Macs. It might have been a Mac too, but I think it was the Mac Classic. So basically, what I had on my desk, a telephone and a word processor. The World Wide Web was really not quite up and running yet, but he told me, "You need to know who I really am. So I want you, over the next three, four, five, six times you work here, that you come to my house," and where his studio was as well. He said, "I want you to go through the file cabinet and read all the letters. I want you to look at everything that's in there. A lot of it's very personal, but this is how you're going to know who I am." And it was an amazing introduction to Mr. Dillingham because there were letters from Beatrice Wood, Ralph Lauren, Georgia O'Keeffe. He was friends with those people and many, many more, but he also had many lovers, and people adored and fell in love with Rick so easily. So I read a lot of love letters as well. That's how I got to know Mr. Dillingham. Rick, what do I remember most vividly about Rick Dillingham is simply that extraordinary energy and passion that he had for life and for everything about it. He rode Harley-Davidson motorcycles. He had a Porsche convertible that he raced around in. He traveled extensively. His lust for life was infinite.
So I feel like that covers questions like 1 through 4 pretty well. I guess if you would be willing to elaborate a little bit about like the nature of your relationship, how it grew over time, because you were with him for 10 years.
Almost yeah. a decade.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Katie. Yes, I was with him for the final decade of his life. And the relationship, well, just starting from the fact that he wanted me to read all his personal letters and know who he was, let's say the intimacy was pretty nearly instantaneous. And he was very generous. And I remember he would, he took really good care of me. And back then, I mean, what people were earning an hour, who knows, but he was generous back in the day, and he always was. And he would come to my birthday parties, and he included me in all of his parties. So even though I was sort of the organizer, what was I there for? Well, to track the work he made. And he had done a marvelous job of this already. I just had to pick up the system, which was that a little 35 millimeter slide would be attached to the corner in a slide sleeve, or individual slide sleeves would be attached to the corner of an index card. Again, there were no databases, not really. And FileMaker Pro came along at some point. Nonetheless, I would write the title of the piece, the date, the measurements. You know, we would just track his work by creating these little index cards and filling numerous cardboard card catalogs, or the boxes that you would put. Were they 4x5? What's the larger one? 4x5? No.
4x8?
4x8. Maybe that big. 4x6. Anyway, index cards. Who even knows what those are now? But nonetheless, I mean, unless you're learning a new language and you have flashcards made out of index cards, this was the great record keeping and tracking, and it honestly was. I mean, for 1985 through 90 something, and we began to create a database, a digital, well, no, not digital, but a database nonetheless. So also, Rick got a lot of fan mail, phone calls, and I took care of all that too. So I was basically administrative support for Rick. And yet we were just great friends, and we had so many friends in common ultimately here in Santa Fe. And we were, we were both part of like the queer community. Mm-hmm. So we shared that and some of our friends who were part of that, but also part of the artistic community and part of the amazing group of artists who had gathered here. And he would have parties, and there would be, well, the party I remember most was for Beatrice Wood. And Bruce Nauman came with his then partner, Harriet Lindenberg. Judy Chicago was also at the party. And Herb, I'm sure Herb Watts must have been at that party. And he would celebrate other people so generously. I loved that about Rick. And when Beatrice Wood couldn't find anyone to publish her autobiography, which is called I Shock Myself, she came to visit, and Beatrice and Rick were sitting together in the living room of the house, and the office was just in an adjacent space. There were no doors in that house particularly. So I could hear the conversation going on. And Beatrice had brought the typed manuscript of I Shock Myself and was showing it to Rick. and lamenting the fact that she had shopped it around and nobody was interested in publishing the autobiography of Beatrice Wood. And Rick, I hear him calling out from that room. He didn't have to speak that loudly, but he called out and said, "Juliet, as of today, we have created Dillingham Press. We will be publishing Beatrice's book." And that was an amazing moment. She did have a printer in Los Angeles who was really interested in printing the book. So we teamed up, and I, this very moment, cannot remember his name or the name of his press. It wasn't a press because we were Dillingham Press. He was the printer. At any rate, that first edition, hard copy and soft copies of Beatrice Wood's autobiography are very highly collectible now. And there was a limited edition in which she made an original drawing and included it with, I'm not sure if it was 50 copies, 25 copies, 75. We'll have to look at the records, but there were the really exquisite drawings included in a number of them. And then the hard copy and soft copy of that first edition are the best, though it was picked up by Chronicle Books after a few years. It went out of print and then Chronicle came back and printed it. We didn't do a huge run, can't tell you how many, but what a joy to, and what an amazing thing for Rick to finance the publication of Beto's autobiography, just like that. He sort of snapped his fingers and everybody went into action. I was close with Rick, there's just no doubt about it. It was not just a work relationship, it was a deep and intimate friendship.
So I guess in thinking about that, and you had mentioned like generosity and in how he was kind of like snap his fingers and, you know, just it just happens, this like magic of who he was. Would you be willing to just describe him a little bit more carefully? You can describe his visage. You can describe his personality, however, okay. You know.
Yeah, sure.
However you choose.
Of course. Well, Rick was larger than life. I mean, first of all, he was 6-something and he wore cowboy boots, which made him even taller. So I don't know exactly, but he had the most beautiful figure. He cut a fine figure, as they say. He was tall and slender, and he wore wonderful clothes. He liked Comme des Garçons in New York quite a bit, and others, Ralph Lauren, because they were friends, but he bought wonderful clothes, fine clothes. And he looked beautiful. He was a handsome man. He always had beard, you know, mustache, kind of the whole deal. And I don't know, did I ever see him without it? I can think that he always had, and sometimes it was longer, sometimes it was shorter, but always the beard. And so he was very masculine for such a queen, we might say. He kind of flaunted the gayness in certain company, but generally Rick was not hiding the fact. Here, mid-1980s and into, yeah, that was kind of early. But, of course, Santa Fe has always had a pretty rich gay and queer and whatever, everybody has, I think, there's always been a kind of comfort in living in Santa Fe as a queer person. But Rick didn't change his behavior, let's say, from group to group. I mean, if it was a dinner party with lots of fancy patrons and art collectors and other artists, he was still Rick, and he was hilarious, and he was a little, he liked to tell jokes or make jokes. Sometimes they were a little cruel, perhaps, and very much off color a lot of the time. And some of the people, and he would have this banter. So it wasn't like he was telling jokes that, you know, he read in a book or recycling jokes. He made his own witty, clever, astute, really, jokes about things. But as I say, sometimes that could be a little tough on whoever was the target of the joke. But his personality was huge, and everyone gravitated toward Rick. I have to say, there are very few people I know that weren't rather infatuated. And one of the fun things I remember were the many, many married men who had an adoration, honestly. They were enamored of Rick, and I just saw it over and over again. And the wives loved him too, but men were really attracted to him. I'm not going to say what transpired, because of course I don't know. Mm-hmm. However, I do know that he was a flirt. He was a big flirt. And he had some powers of seduction. Let's leave it at that. For now, at any rate.
Yeah.
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 Too much fun.
He was too much fun.
Yeah, he was too much fun. I love it.
Everyone so far has mentioned the beard. Mm-hmm. So I don't think I've met a single person so far who remembers Rick without one. Yeah. Yes.
A mark of his manliness.
Was born with it. So I guess thinking about his personality then, because you already spoke about like some of your vivid memories, and we can always revisit that question too. How did you see that personality manifesting itself in his artwork, his practice as a scholar or as an artist, or just as a person?
Right. Well, do you know, he, as I say, the bon vivant, larger than life, out there roaring down the road on his one of his several Harley Davidsons. But backing up to the idea of his personality, it also had a very quiet, deep, meditative, focused aspects, like that were really the antithesis of that crazy guy. That wild and crazy guy. He could focus for hours and hours at a time when he was in the studio making. So I think his personality, I mean, he was having fun, let's face it. The fact that he created this entire process of making ceramic vessels and bringing them to a certain state of finish. That would be the bisque firing would occur after he brought it to the surface to where he wanted it, the shape, the everything. He would break them, and he broke them very methodically. It's not like you hold the piece of ceramic up and drop it on the floor. He had a position he worked in. He was kneeling in the studio quite a bit, which I thought was interesting and kind of tough on one's knees and back, but and then he had buckets that he used as little stools to sit on. Sometimes he was on his knees, sometimes he's sitting low, but he's close to the ground and to the floor of his studio, which was concrete slab. And he had a particular stick. I don't know what happened to it, but it was like a 1x2. It was a nice little, not a stick, it was a piece of wood. It was a real piece of wood, not like a stick off the tree in the patio or something, the courtyard. But he would tap that against this bisque-fired clay. And it wasn't like he could control, and he never said he could control the breaks, because he liked the surprising things that happened as these ceramics were deconstructed with the stick. And the hammering with the stick. But I do believe he had a certain kind of control. And that through the years, this practice that went on forever, I mean, early on, of course, the vessels were not broken. Mm-hmm. But at a certain point, and I think based on the fact that he had done so much research at the Maxwell Museum of Art in Albuquerque as an undergraduate, and he was putting pots back together at the Maxwell. So one can only assume or extrapolate that the process of reconstructing pots might have led him to the idea of breaking his own work and reconstructing it. And the reconstruction of those pots, again, it was always surprising. He had such a knowledge of glazes that he knew what he was doing. And yet when those shards were fired, because each shard was treated as an individual canvas, one might say, each shard was painted, glazed, I should say glazed, in a pattern. And then when it all came back together, you're talking crazy quilt. But the shards were glazed, they were fired, then the piece was reconstructed. And he would glue it back together with basically white glue, Elmer's glue. He often put ashes from the fireplace into a glue mixture that became the grout. So the pot would be glued back together. At that point, he was able, he had left some preconceived ideas about what he was doing, certainly were there. And again, his focus and his understanding of his own work and the materials led to the fact that when a pot came back together, there were bare spots of bisque showing through, sometimes in grid patterns, sometimes in spirals, but different spaces that remained untouched by glaze. And in those spots, the ghost spots of sort, would be applied gold leaf or silver leaf or copper leaf. And that is the sort of grand finale of creating the surfaces of his ceramic works, would be the application of the gold leaf or silver or copper, or sometimes all three on the same pot. There is an example that I think perhaps is in this exhibition where he used enamel at the very end and painted some rather surprisingly bold and garish colors onto the pot. He was not afraid of pushing the limits with regard to shape, size, texture, patterns, crazy patterns. And so the work never got boring, and especially the gas cans, which came very early, but were sort of the poor cousin to all the globes and cones and cylinders. People were not very enamored. They were not in love with the gas cans. I think now, you know, when you look at the entire show, you will discover, and you'll have the experience that the place where he experimented the most throughout his making, that would be the gas cans. He really pushed the limits of what clay can do. Scholarly practice. Well, so his personality in his artwork, I mean, there's a seriousness, there's a focus, there's a kind of concentration. And then of course there's this frivolity. I mean, he's constantly doing things that are surprising, and he even surprised himself. As I say, he knew what he was doing, but that glaze firing would completely transform and surprise very often what the heck that pot is going to end up looking like. He was one of the leading scholars of Pueblo Native American clay work, ceramics, coming from his study of history of the Hopi and Pueblo making, the women who were very often the leading potters. And Rick became obsessed with the idea that what potters were doing in the historic period was being lost to the contemporary making of Native American pots as they became more commercial. Of course, they were making pots for ceremonies, pots that were about the individual pueblo, the individual maker.
Yeah, the closed practice.
A very closed and a very private situation where then they also, of course, as Native American pottery became popular as a collectible, there was a period where some makers were using commercial clay bodies, mm-hmm. or even greenware that they purchased and then would paint, but they were not digging their own clay. Of course, some always did, but some not so much. And Rick would take historic pots out to the different pueblos and towns in Hopi, villages in Hopi land, and show them the history. We'd take the pots back out and remind them a bit. And I mean, I may be stretching it, but I'm not uncomfortable saying that a revival of the clay bodies, the glazes, the techniques, that Rick had a lot to do with bringing tradition back to the commercial work that Native potters were making. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he wrote several books. So the man knew how to focus. I think I need to say, for all his silliness and frivolity, he was someone who could focus and produce first Seven Families in Pueblo pottery, then expanded much many years later to 14 families, mm-hmm. in Pueblo pottery, and then the massively beautiful Laguna, Acoma Laguna pottery book. Yes, and Rick was an enigma in many ways. Some people knew him only as a party boy, but all of his friends and fellow artists knew him to also have this very serious and focused side,
yeah.
that could produce such great work, both his own work and an eye for everything Native pottery. And also he collected contemporary ceramics from his peers and colleagues.
So I guess that leads us into the next question of how would you describe Rick's relationship with the communities that he worked with and the communities that he played with, mm-hmm. you know? Because mm-hmm. it sounds like he was a bit of a dichotomous human being, private, public.
Maybe trichotomous.
Trichotomous. You can take multitudes.
Polycotomy. At any rate, we're going to make a new word up for who Rick was, mm-hmm. in relationship with various communities, because he did. And interestingly, even though a lot of us knew each other, I knew certainly many of his friends, but it felt to me that he also had some secret lives that I was not privy to. And I think everyone who knew Rick would say, well, yes, I knew Rick. I was intimate with Rick, but perhaps there were aspects of his life that we didn't know very well, that we weren't even aware of, perhaps. But from what I observed, I can only talk about that part, was that his relationships with the old ladies or the old women, potters from many of the pueblos, and especially the Rio Grande, along the Rio Grande. But he joked with them, he teased them. He was serious about buying their work and selling their work and making sure they made wonderful money from their labors. But he was always teasing the women, and they would come, you know, they always had a plastic, blue, pink, green, plastic laundry basket, you might say, that they were ubiquitous. The pots arrived wrapped in terry cloth towels in laundry baskets. It's just sort of vivid that that's how they did it. And Rick would open, you know, they'd bring the laundry baskets into the house, and then they'd sit and look at everything, and Rick would discuss with them and whatever he would take. I mean, he pretty much always took everything, as I recall. But he was, his humor was very much alive with the ladies, and he loved making them laugh. He just adored making them laugh. And he was very good at it. And again, I think there were some really off-color jokes that were made, and they just would, the hand would go over their mouths, and you could hear this giggling in the living room going on. But he was very light and lovely with the Native American community. And what else can I say? I mean, he's legendary as a country and Western dancer at the Albuquerque Social Club. And so he was just slaying them on the dance floor. And everyone was impressed with the way he moved, his physicality, his grace. He had some of his favorite partners, but I think he danced with everyone. And I think that they would arrive in Albuquerque on the motorcycles or whatever the case might be, but arrive in Albuquerque and he would start dancing. This is again, country and Western type dancing, swing, whatever, but two step. And he would start dancing and he wouldn't stop. I mean, barely did he stop until they shut the place down. So it was just, he put so much energy out. And that was the thing. He had an extraordinary level of energy. And the dancing was one of the great, I think, releases and, you know, just celebrations for him was the dancing. And who else? I mean, he was so well respected, I will say, you know, various communities. I mean, we have the Native American friends and colleagues and then the whole gay, like, go out and have fun community. And then there would be the directors of museums all over the country, but most especially here, School of American Research, which is what is now the School of Advanced Research, but SAR figured prominently in his studies and his relationships. And so the curators and directors of all the museums in Santa Fe, he had really rich relationships with all of them. That's the part I saw. I think this is true. And I don't think he had very many. I mean, he did have squabbles.
When you talk that much trash.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Rick's sharp tongue, shall we say, acid tongue, probably did get him in trouble more than I want to remember or am able to remember. Nonetheless, I think he was very well respected as a scholar and as a dealer of Native American pots, because you know, that was, I watched some crazy stuff go on. I mean, fake pots, people being accused. I think Rick especially was very careful. And as I remember, there were laws against selling certain pre-Columbian and such, or, you know, the provenance and things like that. So I think he tried very, very hard to be the most scrupulous and honest kind of pot dealer, as some people say. But he had a vast knowledge, and I think he could spot a fake. And whereas I think there were people here in some galleries in Santa Fe who were selling some very questionable pots.
We won't name names.
No, we won't.
Probably because we can't.
No, we can't. But I think Rick was as honest as he possibly could be.
So do you have a favorite? I know you've shared a lot of stories already, but is there something that you keep very special, you know, and you're also welcome to share more than one story, you know, and I guess that could also lead us into our last question of, like, is there anything else that you want us to know? Is there anything that you've not said here that you want to share with us?
Well, Katie, I think that the show that you have curated, that you are curating, that will be opening in October, is bringing together a lot of aspects of Rick into visual reality, his gay life, his scholarly life, his life as a maker, his relationships with the Native Americans, certainly, and their making of pop. You're bringing a lot together, and I guess this isn't exactly a memory, but what I want to say is thank you, because it did feel like during his lifetime he compartmentalized a lot, and he had a lover who lived in Spain, and for a long time none of us really even knew that, and he would travel. And of course, I think he had a lover in every port as a way of saying he was an amorous guy and irresistible. So there was a whole life of loving and being promiscuous and celebrating who he was. He was just great about that. But until some letters started arriving at the house from someone named Jose. Beatrice always called him Jose, which is also correct. But at any rate, this man became really one of, if not the love of Rick's life. And my memory, a great memory, is the first time that Jose came to visit in Santa Fe, because mainly Rick would go there, and that's why I say, it was sort of a well-kept secret by Rick, I guess. Maybe some other people knew about Jose, but when Jose appeared and was just as big and gorgeous and graceful and just stunning man with a big beard, you know, everyone just nearly fainted, but because they were such a perfect match. So that was a really joyful thing to see. Jose and Rick together on the various times when they would Rick would show him off, or you know, Jose would come, and they would go traveling around the United States and all kinds of cool stuff. And when he'd go to Europe, and they would travel around Europe. I mean, there were adventures that I have absolutely no idea. I'm not privy to some of that, but there are cards and letters that in the archive. Which is here at the museum. And I do want to get into the archive, so I'll put it on record right here that it would be a delight if we could annotate some of the letters and different materials in the archive, because at some point no one's going to know exactly who was that? You know, because he had these great letter exchanges with so many, not just his lovers and secret admirers, but also with other artists, and I think that needs to be looked at too. I look forward to that. At any rate, I'm trying to think of what else. I guess, you know, it's just so vivid. This is a tough memory to share, because it's toward the very end of his life when two things happened, and this was, well, the first was he went roaring off to Sturgis to the big motorcycle event in Sturgis. Is that in September or October? It's in the fall, I believe.
Yeah, September.
But when he goes roaring off to Sturgis, and he has a backpack that he's wearing, and it's not like supplies for camping or for his motorcycle. They are actually, he has in there a pump that is full of the anti-HIV viral treatments called cocktails. Mm-hmm. And he would be riding off into the sunset, not the sunrise, he never left that early. But he would be driving across the country and getting his infusion of AIDS, anti-AIDS related drugs while he's riding the motorcycle. He was to the very end out there and moving. And it didn't matter if he was having, you know, like an IV treatment, he was still riding down the road. And I thought he was just absolutely amazing and heroic in that respect. And my other favorite is...
Wait. I know.
Activities of the museum cannot be avoided.
Cannot.
No, we're not in a soundproof booth.
Sadly. No.
But the other is that he died on January 20th or 21st. I think there's a little confusion because I think it was right around midnight. But at any rate, early in January of 1994, let me back up because we would have to check the historic record, but I believe it was New Year's Eve, and I believe it was Barbara Streisand in Las Vegas at one of the big hotels. And Rick was there. He went to Las Vegas. He was very ill and pretty weak at that point, but he got himself to Las Vegas to see Babs' final, was it really, performance, you know, because she was forever retiring and then not, but for Rick, it was Babs' final appearance because it's the last time he saw her. But it was just so crazy with what he was going through at that point and his physical condition, that he was there. And I know he just adored going. That was the other thing. He would fly all over the United States and maybe Europe, but for sure fly to see these amazing, especially Cher, right? Or Barbara Streisand. Those were probably the most favorites. And just his love of popular culture, I guess you would say, and being in the moment and of the moment. That was Rick.
Wow. I feel like that's a good place to kind of wrap it up.
I think so.
Yeah.
And I know that you're getting different people to talk about their life with Rick or their relationships with Rick. And so I hope it's a big kaleidoscope of possibility and recollections that will paint, you know, a beautiful portrait. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And then I do have one more. Is that okay? So one more question for you. I understand that you managed Rick's end of life work and the management of his estate as well. Would you be willing to speak a little bit about that and how the museum kind of came into possession? This exhibition in particular pulls a lot from where those works wound up. And
yes.
Yeah, if you're
of
willing.
Course. Mm-hmm. Well, yes, I was co-executor of the Dillingham estate. And again, I think it speaks to the relationship and the trust we had in one another, that he asked me to, he had some ideas about certain pieces of his own work, which would go to this museum or that collection or whatever. But mainly he asked me to divide the collection up, and he had retained many, many works of his own. He loved selling and he sold a lot, but he also kept back a great deal of work from the very early works in the 70s, early 70s. Mm-hmm. To some of the last works. So he asked me to divide them up and to gift them. And the curators came from, and you might have to help me here, Katie, because I mean, I know, you know, the New Mexico Museum of Art, of course, was part of the legacy. His legacy would live on in your collections, but also Arizona State, the University of Hawaii, because he'd gone. These are places where he went and he created amazing workshops and experiences for students in many of these places. Albuquerque Museum of Art also. So that's Arizona, Albuquerque, Hawaii, New Mexico Museum of Art.
UNM.
And UNM, right, which was his alma mater from his undergraduate degree. I think maybe those are the places. Five, that sounds right to me.
Yeah.
So maybe I do kind of remember. But what was amazing was that certain pieces just spoke to me. Like there was a gas can that was a blue wave sort of form. And I think that went to Hawaii. I believe it did. Yes, mm-hmm. Good. You can substantiate that. There are certain pieces that needed to live in certain areas, in certain watery or mountainous or whatever the terrain, desert. But he had these marvelous experiences of teaching in most of these places or being a student in many of these places. Mm-hmm. But that was a lovely kind of intimacy to his. The dispersion of his collection of his own work was very, well, I'd like to say it's very thoughtful, but I do think I was very thoughtful. And I really think that by the end of that decade of having been in Rick's life, I think I almost could channel Rick. I think I did channel Rick. And Rick channeled back to me. There was a roadrunner after Rick died. It was mainly about birds coming to me and being Rick. And there was a roadrunner that would hang out on the wall next to the window in my little office. And wrapping up the estate after Rick died, I was in that house for another 2 years, wrapping things up without him. And yet, I will say, not exactly without him, because there was an energy. He pulled some amazing magical tricks on some people who were disputing the estate and trying to paint me as the villain of how the estate was being appraised and dispersed. At any rate, I'll just say I won. But it was Rick that won, because Rick really engineered some amazing things that happened after he was dead. But one of my favorites is the Roadrunner, which honestly does symbolize Rick beautifully. The speed of the Roadrunner, the incredible plumage and sleekness of the Roadrunner, is very Dillingham. But there was also a hummingbird in the courtyard that kept showing up and would just come right next to my head. And so that's pretty interesting to feel that. And whenever I go to, well, pretty much every year from forever, I go to Indian Market, I can so feel his presence. And I am so grateful that some of the many, many Native makers, the women especially, we always speak his name, and then we cry, and then we hug, and we just are so happy that Rick came to Earth, you know, to do the work he did.
That's it. That's it. I'd say we're good.
So that marks the end of our interview. It is 1:29 p.m.